Hello and welcome to Crime Monthly presents Evil Uncovered, where each week we investigate bone-chilling cases of true life terror. In the final episode of this season, we're delving into the sinister world of children who kill, exploring shocking crimes where youthful innocence twisted into acts of unimaginable violence. So, join us as we take a journey into the minds of three teenagers whose deadly decisions left a trail of devastation. Listener discretion is advised. Our first story takes us to Santa Cruz in California, a laid-back paradise of lazy days and balmy evenings. But terror once lurked behind its picture-perfect exterior, and in 2015, an unthinkable act changed it forever when 8-year-old Madison Middleton was murdered. The consequences of that heinous crime continue to reverberate almost a decade later, but the person responsible would turn out to be little more than a child themselves. July the 26th was a typical Sunday afternoon, and Madison was playing in the courtyard of her home at the Tannery Arts Centre. She'd lived there with her mother Laura for 6 years, and they thrived in the bustling community. It had been set up to create affordable housing for aspiring artists and was extremely close-knit. Madison's mum would later say,
"We were happy there, and Maddie was growing up beautifully. Bright, perky, and full of heart, she was the best thing I ever made."
However, behind the tannery was a secluded wood dubbed the Fairy Glen, where those plagued by addiction would conceal their drug-taking from view. Because of this, Madison, who was affectionately known as Chatty Maddie, knew not to talk to strangers or leave the tannery's play areas, which were monitored by CCTV. That day, Madison had arranged a playdate with a friend. First, though, she took her brand new scooter out for a spin and was captured on CCTV just after 5 p.m, whizzing around. But when Laura went to call her daughter in for dinner just after 6 p.m, she was nowhere to be found. Laura assumed she must have decided to play inside and walked over to her friend's apartment. But the little girl told Laura that, when she'd gone out to meet Madison in the courtyard, she wasn't there. Laura started knocking on the doors of other neighbours, hoping Madison had gone to visit a different friend instead. But when there was no sign of the 8-year-old, a now frantic Laura called the authorities. They immediately began conducting a door-to-door search of the complex's 100 apartments and would later say,
"We knew right off the bat that Madison's disappearance was completely out of character. She'd never left the tannery without her mother, yet she seemed to have vanished into thin air."
By 11 the next morning, the Santa Cruz Police Department were joined by a canine unit, a search and rescue team, and over 50 FBI officers, but there was still no sign of the child. With no leads and such a small amount of time between the last sighting of Maddie and the search starting, police began to believe the answer to her disappearance had to lay within that apartment complex. Then, on July the 27th, Laura's worst nightmare came true.
"We discovered Madison's body inside a bag, stuffed into a recycling bin on the first floor of the tannery. Everyone's hearts just sank. We'd all been praying that she'd be found alive."
As the residents gathered in shock, officers set their sights on someone they believed knew more about Madison's disappearance than he was letting on. That was 15-year-old Adrian Jerry Gonzalez, affectionately known as AJ, who lived in the tannery complex with his mother, Reggie.
"We'd started to become suspicious of the teenager due to his behavior in the aftermath of Madison vanishing. He'd rapidly inserted himself into proceedings, joining the search and questioning officers on the progress of the investigation. He was watching intently as we searched the bins and, when we found Maddie's body, he started running."
Authorities arrested AJ as Reggie looked on, screaming in despair. A single mother like Laura, she'd escaped an abusive relationship and overcome drug and alcohol addictions. Now she worked hard to provide her children with a stable home where they could thrive. And it seemed they were thriving, especially AJ. He acted as a counselor for the younger children and was often seen giving them lessons in how to yo-yo, which was one of his passions. His arrest was a shock for the residents, with one telling the local press,
"We love this guy. all of us. If you ask us what we think of him, we'd tell you he's an outstanding kid. He's like our poster child.
Yet, AJ's social media painted a different picture. Posting photos featuring references to suicide alongside disturbing captions, he was also said to have abused his pet dog, an incident that led friends to implore the teen to seek help, something he didn't do. At a press conference the next day, the full extent of the horror suffered by Maddie would be revealed.
Local police have confirmed that an examination of Madison's body showed her mouth had been duct taped, and she'd been beaten and sexually assaulted before being killed. Adrian Gonzalez admitted his guilt and told investigators what happened to Madison in those final hours. Acting alone, this teenage boy committed one of the most monstrous crimes in this state's memory, and all against a little girl who knew and trusted him.
AJ had told Madison to come to his apartment for some ice cream. With no reason to fear him, she'd followed him home, but while she helped herself to the promised treat, AJ launched a brutal attack from behind. After subduing her, he taped up her mouth, then sexually assaulted and beat her before strangling her. He forced her body into a bag, but when he realized she wasn't dead, he stabbed her repeatedly. Even then, a coroner confirmed she was still alive and would ultimately die from positional asphyxiation inside the bag. The public were outraged, and although AJ was a teenager, calls were made for him to be charged as an adult. The mayor of Santa Cruz told news outlets,
"Being charged and tried as an adult is the only appropriate form of punishment in a crime this horrifying."
But despite his confession, AJ entered a plea of not guilty, and his defense team fought to bring into play a new bill that protected teenagers from being tried in adult court. The bill was set up so juveniles wouldn't be subjected to the horrors of an adult jail when they'd committed crimes as children. But the legislation was designed to protect those who'd committed non-violent crimes, not those who deserved a term of incarceration that reflected the severity of their crime. If tried in an adult court, AJ was facing up to 120 years in prison. In stark contrast, a juvenile court trial would mean he'd be released when he turned 25. Petitions were set up attempting to stop this from happening, but ultimately the Supreme Court agreed the case would be tried in juvenile court. The prospect of AJ receiving a minimal term in juvenile detention, followed by his re-release into society, caused uproar. The district attorney for Santa Cruz said,
"Allowing teenagers accused of murder to remain in the juvenile court is not promoting public safety, because not all of them can be safely rehabilitated. Adrian Gonzalez is not someone who will ever be safe to be released."
As the trial approached, AJ changed his plea to guilty on 6 felonies, including kidnap, rape, and murder. Addressing the court at his sentencing, he said,
"I understand that there is very little I can say after all the pain and suffering I have caused. My goal is to work on my issues so that no one else has to experience what you have endured. I am aware that doesn't change the fact that I have brought you tragedy, loss, and devastation. I am hopeful that you accept my apologies for the actions I have done and what they have brought you."
Maddie's father chose to make the brave decision to forgive AJ. He said,
"That does not make anything easier. It just allows me peace. The alternative could be to hold on to the darkness, but this would only consume my soul. I refuse to poison my soul in existence. Forgiveness is the only path, and I believe that Madison would agree."
Ultimately, the judge imposed the maximum sentence possible, making AJ eligible for release in October 2024. Madison's mother, who suffered severe depression in the wake of her daughter's murder, said,
"It's terrifying that he could be released at 25. This law affects not only my family, but anyone who has suffered a crime at the hands of a juvenile. This was a sociopathic murder. He's the next Ed Kemper."
Of her daughter, she said,
"Madison was the love of my life. She brought joy to everyone she met. She was charming. She was artistic. She wasn't afraid of anything."
Despite his rehabilitation efforts, including participation in therapy and behavioral programs, many believe Gonzalez still represents a danger to the public. As this podcast was recorded, a judge had just denied his automatic release at age 25, and a trial was set to take place at any time. By the time you hear this, he may have been incarcerated in an adult prison to continue to pay for his crimes, or he could be walking the streets as a free man. Our second story takes us from the laid-back environs of Santa Cruz to the heart of Elko County, Nevada, a region steeped in the traditions of horse riding and rodeo. Here, everyone knows everyone, and trust is the bedrock of every relationship. But on March the 8th, 2020, this trust was shattered in the most unimaginable way. It was to be the beginning of a nightmare that would unravel the very fabric of their close community, revealing a betrayal beyond all comprehension. Gabrielle Ulacki, who was known to everyone as Brittany, was a vibrant 16-year-old who had an unbreakable bond with her family and a deep love of horses. Her whole life was entwined with the rhythms of the rodeo, and Brittany's days were filled with the scent of hay and the sound of hooves as she tirelessly worked around all the local ranches. She was a cowgirl through and through, and her spirit was as wild and free as the animals she adored. The rodeo community was where Brittany truly felt at home, and it was here that she met 18-year-old Bryce Dickey. Their friendship blossomed within this close circle, and Bryce was readily embraced by Brittany's loving family. He was more than just a friend to their beloved girl. He was like a big brother, and their trust in him was unwavering. On that fateful day in March, it was this trust that led Brittany's devoted dad, James, to allow Bryce to drive his daughter home after they'd finished watching James rehearse with his band. The last words Brittany said to her father that evening were,
"I'll beat you home, Dad."
And as James watched his daughter leave, he had no reason to worry. But far from beating him home, there was no sign of Brittany when James arrived back. And, as the hours passed and Brittany still didn't return, a profound sense of dread began to creep in. Multiple, increasingly frantic calls and texts went unanswered, and James's concern grew with each passing minute, prompting him to contact the authorities. Although Brittany had only been missing for a few hours, it was unlike her to be out of touch, and the investigation kicked off with urgency. The entire community rallied together to distribute flyers and organise search parties, demonstrating the tight-knit bond shared among the residents. Drones and dogs were also used to cover the vast areas of Nevada desert surrounding Brittany's last known location. And as detectives sought to piece together the last known movements of the young girl, they spoke to Bryce. But when he was quizzed, he was shocked and concerned at her disappearance. He told them,
"When we left her dad, we just started driving around listening to music. I guess we'd been driving for about 3.5 hours before Brittany asked me to take her over to Spring Creek High School. She said she was meeting a friend there."
Bryce told police that he had no idea who this mysterious friend was, but insisted that he dropped Brittany there, as requested, and said the last thing he saw was Brittany getting into a green Ford pickup truck. He could give only a vague description of the stranger driving, saying,
"All I can tell you is that he was a tall, white male, and he was wearing a cowboy hat. Guess that doesn't narrow it down hereabouts, though."
With scant information to go on, an official missing persons report was filed, and a tip line set up, asking for any potential witnesses to come forward with information about the vehicle Bryce had described. Believing Brittany had either been abducted or run away, police returned to Bryce to gather more information. It was at this time he provided authorities with the unanswered Snapchat messages he had sent his best friend, asking her if she was okay. But he had little else to add to his initial account. As the police investigation continued, every piece of evidence was catalogued, and interviews with Brittany's friends and acquaintances were conducted to uncover any leads. The FBI was consulted on a profile for a potential kidnapping suspect, and digital footprints were scrutinised for any clues about Brittany's interactions before her disappearance. Still, there was nothing. Hours became days, and the community held its breath, waiting for any news, any sign of Brittany. But on March the 11th, a discovery was made that would break the hearts of everyone who knew her. Brittany's partially clothed body was discovered in a remote stretch of the scorching Nevada desert, known as Berner Basin. A trail of blood and disturbed earth led from the edge of the highway to her remains, indicating she had been dragged to that final resting place from a vehicle. Her body had been crudely wrapped in a blue tarpaulin, and a used condom and a pair of earbud headphones were retrieved from the scene. The autopsy revealed the grim truth that Brittany had been raped before being strangled, and the community was engulfed in grief, struggling to comprehend the loss of such a vibrant young life. A memorial was held in Brittany's honour, where her devastated friends and family released balloons in a poignant tribute. Among those mourning was Bryce, who took to social media to express his sorrow. He wrote,
"At around 8 in the morning, we all started meeting up at my house to grieve and mourn Brittany's life, which was taken far too soon. That day, I had tears of pain and joy. I wish you could have seen the amount of us that came together to honor you, sis. We love you so much. Just know that you won't ever be forgotten."
The small, close-knit community was reeling, unable to fathom who could commit such a heinous act. Yet police had begun to focus their suspicions on someone they believed might be closer to the case than anyone had imagined. As the now murder investigation deepened, they turned back to Bryce, who they suspected was the last person to have seen Brittany alive. And while his account had at first seemed straightforward, now there were red flags, officers would later say.
Bryce Dickey had been able to accurately describe the clothing Brittany was wearing when her body was found, as well as confirming she had her cell phone and a set of keys with her. It seemed highly unlikely he would be able to positively state that she had these items had he not been present at the crime scene.
Investigators then asked Bryce to provide a voluntary DNA sample, which he agreed to. By March the 13th, forensic experts had been able to extract samples from the earbuds and the condom, as well as from DNA found underneath Brittany's fingernails. When Bryce's DNA was tested against them, police had a hit. Confronted with the evidence, Bryce changed his story again.
"When we first asked about his relationship with Brittany, he told us they were not romantically involved and had never engaged in a physical relationship. This time around, he told us he had engaged in consensual sex with Brittany on the day that she disappeared, but maintained that he had nothing to do with her murder."
The authorities were not convinced, and their suspicions were further fueled when a search of Bryce's home uncovered a pair of blood-stained boots. This discovery was the final piece of the puzzle, leading to his arrest and a charge of murder. Police theorized that Bryce had fabricated the mysterious stranger and green pickup truck to draw suspicion away from himself, but the wealth of forensic evidence meant he could no longer deny committing the crime. Bryce went on trial in May 2022, and it soon became national news.
"In court today, Bryce Dickey watched silently as the prosecution presented a robust case, highlighting both the inconsistencies in his statements and the DNA evidence that was central to his arrest. His defense team argued the evidence was circumstantial and attempted to cast doubt on the forensic evidence, alleging contamination. But among the compelling evidence presented by the prosecution was a former girlfriend who testified that Dickey would regularly choke her during their relationship. It was a claim that drew gasps from the packed courtroom."
It took the jury just 4 hours to find Bryce Dickey guilty of first-degree murder and sexual assault, a verdict that brought a mix of relief and sorrow. The emotional impact on Brittany's family was profound, and her mother stood before the court to address the man who had once been a trusted friend. Her voice was trembling yet resolute as she said,
"The past 2 years we have been surviving, not living. Our lives have been very dark and chaotic without Brittany in them. I believed your ridiculous lies and your story about the green truck, and you let me comfort you knowing you had raped and murdered my daughter. I hope the guilt eats you up inside and drives you to the complete chaos that my mind lives in."
Speaking to reporters later, she recounted the painful memory of comforting Dickey at Brittany's memorial, unaware of his guilt.
"I grabbed his cheeks and tilted him towards me so he was looking in my eyes. For someone who can betray a best friend like that, take her life, then go and celebrate her life with her family, go out looking for her? He's a psychopath."
Her words were a terrible reminder of the trust that had been shattered, and Brittany's father James echoed this sentiment, saying,
"There is no worse betrayal than this because she really thought he was a good friend. She trusted everybody. She always saw the good.
Dickie was sentenced to life behind bars with the possibility of parole after 20 years. However, an additional 50 years was later added for a second charge of sexual assault. He continues to languish behind bars, and Brittany's family are adamant that he should remain there for the rest of his life. The sense of shock and disbelief was a dark cloud that would linger for years as Brittany's family and the community were left to pick up the pieces, their lives forever altered by the actions of Bryce Dickie. The courtroom doors closed, but the echoes of that day would resonate long after, providing a stark reminder of the fragility of trust and the devastating impact of betrayal.
Crime Monthly magazine is dedicated to all things true crime, where you'll find all the latest news, in-depth features, interviews with leading experts, and so much more. We've even got your essential entertainment guide for the month ahead. Buy in all good shops and supermarkets or subscribe now at greatmagazines.co.uk.
Our final story of the season takes us to the small town of Fayetteville in Georgia, which was rocked to its core in August 2004, when police entered the home of Carl and Sarah Collier. They were confronted by a scene of unimaginable horror as the loving and respected couple had been hacked to death in a frenzy of violence. And that horror would only escalate when the perpetrators were caught and found to be two teenage girls. So, what could have led them to such a dreadful destiny? Born on March 23, 1989, Holly Harvey's childhood was marred by instability and chaos. Her mother, Carla Collier, had a history of criminal activity and had been living on the run with Jean Harvey, a convicted criminal, the pair assuming false identities to evade capture. When Jean was arrested in 1988, Carla discovered she was pregnant with Holly. With nowhere else to turn, Carla returned to her parents' home. Carl and Sarah Collier, high school sweethearts who'd married in 1949, were unable to have biological children and had adopted Carla and her brother Kevin. They were hard-working, peaceful people, deeply involved in their local church. But Carla's return and the birth of baby Holly brought turmoil to their lives. Carla would later say,
"I was more interested in partying than being a mother, and that meant my parents were left to raise Holly."
Despite their best efforts, the situation grew untenable, and Carl and Sarah eventually kicked Carla and her baby out. They moved in with Carla's brother Kevin, who tried to provide some stability, but Carla's involvement in the sex trade and her addiction to drugs would eventually lead to her selling her own child for sex at the age of 12. In 2001, Carla was sentenced to 5 months in jail, and Holly went back to live with her uncle. She began to thrive, but this period of stability was short-lived. When Carla was released, Kevin, increasingly fed up with his sister's behaviour, had no choice but to kick them out, and Holly was once again collateral damage in her mother's chaotic life. In 2002, Carla was sent to prison again, and 13-year-old Holly stayed with a friend. It was during this time that she met Sandra Ketchum, a girl with a similarly troubled past. As a baby, Sandra was often left starved and dirty, and her father Tim filed for custody when she was 15 months old, winning the battle against her mother. But Tim married several times during Sandra's childhood, and they moved around constantly. It was Tim's third wife, Beth, who brought a glimmer of hope into the child's life. Beth loved Sandra, and Sandra loved her. It seemed as if things might finally be turning around for her. But as Sandra entered high school, she fell in with the wrong crowd and began abusing drugs. Desperate to help her, Beth and Tim sent her first to rehab, then a juvenile center, and eventually moved to a new town for a fresh start. It was in the crowded hallways of their high school that Holly and Sandra first crossed paths. Drawn together by a shared sense of alienation, they quickly became inseparable. Their friendship blossomed as they confided in each other, finding a rare understanding and acceptance that neither had experienced before.
"We just clicked, you know? It was like we were meant to find each other, and we cared for each other in a way no one else in our lives had."
They spent countless hours together, sharing their dreams, fears, and the pain of their pasts. In each other, they found a refuge from the harsh realities of their lives. As their bond deepened, their friendship evolved into a romantic relationship. It was a natural progression for them, but their love was met with hostility and rejection from their community and families. The small conservative town of Fayetteville was not kind to the young couple. They were subjected to vicious homophobic slurs and ostracized by their peers. The backlash from their families was equally severe. Holly's grandparents, Carl and Sarah, were pillars of the conservative Baptist community and were particularly disapproving. Despite the mounting pressure, Holly and Sandy clung to each other. Their shared traumas and the societal rejection they faced only fueled their bond. They found solace in their love, even as it pushed them further into the margins of their community. They would sneak in and out of each other's homes, finding brief moments of peace amid the chaos.
We were just trying to survive, to find a little bit of happiness in a world that didn't want us.
But their love, once a beacon of hope, became a catalyst for the tragic events that would soon unfold. And the bond that had given them strength would ultimately lead them down a path of no return. Holly's grandparents had hoped to provide her with stability, but their attempts to control her behaviour were now pushing her further into rebellion. Holly and Sandra began using meth and cocaine, and the Collier's disapproval reached boiling point when they discovered the extent of Holly's drug use. They contacted Sandra's stepmother, Beth, to inform her of the situation, hoping to put an end to the girl's relationship. But this only fueled Holly's anger and resentment. The Colliers, desperate to regain control, took Holly to the police station and had her charged as a runaway. She received 3 months probation, and in a fit of rage, she threatened her grandparents, vowing to kill them. And the seeds of a deadly plan were sown. At around 11 p.m. on August the 1st, Sandra snuck into the basement at Holly's grandparents' house. There, the girls smoked weed, and when they ran out, they contacted a dealer named Calvin Lawson. He agreed to supply them with more drugs in exchange for sex with Holly. He later admitted that he'd laced a joint with crack cocaine before having sex with the 14-year-old. At 5:30 a.m., Lawson took the girls home, where they spent the next few hours listening to music and smoking, their minds becoming clouded with paranoia and anger. In the afternoon, Sandra suggested they steal Holly's grandparents' truck to get away for a while, to which Holly replied,
"If we wanted to do that, I reckon we'd have to kill them."
She would later testify that she didn't mean anything by her comment, but the plan was in motion. Sandra called a friend to ask for a gun, but when that attempt failed, Holly went into the kitchen. She retrieved a large carving knife, and Sandra tested its sharpness by slashing through a mattress and a framed painting of some puppies. As a grim reminder of their intentions, Holly then wrote on her arm,
"Keys. Kill. Money. Jewelry."
The girls knew the Colliers would come downstairs if they smelled cannabis, so they smoked the rest of a joint. As the scent lured Carl and Sarah to the basement, Sandra hid under the bed while Holly concealed the knife in her waistband. But instead of scolding them, Carl and Sarah said they'd just come down to look for a suitcase. It wasn't enough to stop Holly suddenly grabbing the knife, and in a moment of blind rage, she stabbed her grandmother 3 times in the back. As Sarah screamed and fought back, Carl lunged at Holly, punching her in the chin. Despite their injuries, the Colliers managed to pin Holly to the bed, but she struggled free and stabbed Carl in the chest. Bleeding heavily, Carl stumbled out of the basement as Sandra came out from under the bed and screamed at Holly,
"Go and get him! He's going to call the police!"
Handing Sandra the knife, Holly ran upstairs after her grandfather, ripping the phone from his hand. Carl grabbed a knife, but Holly was able to wrestle it from him just as she was joined by Sandra. Carl threw a coffee cup at them but missed. Holly then closed her eyes and began frantically stabbing Carl. The fatal wound pierced his heart, and Holly watched her grandfather stagger around the kitchen until he finally fell to the floor. The girls then went back down to the basement to find Sarah was still alive. Coldly, Sandra told Holly,
"You have to finish her now."
And as instructed, Holly delivered the fatal blow. The girls were drenched in blood as they packed a change of clothes, took Carl's mobile phone, the murder weapons, and some jewellery. They fled the scene in Carl's truck, leaving behind a gruesome tableau of violence and death. With no clear plan, they drove for hours. The drive was tense, filled with the weight of their actions and the uncertainty of their future. As they neared the coast at Tybee Island, the truck ran out of petrol. Stranded, they made their way to the beach. There they encountered a couple of boys. Desperate and out of options, Holly and Sandra asked if they could spend the night at their house. The boys, unaware of the girl's dark secret, agreed to help. They took them to their home where their mother, showing a kindness the girls had rarely experienced, allowed them to stay for the night. Meanwhile, back in Fayetteville, the police were piecing together the horrific crime scene. Carl was found in the kitchen, lying on his stomach, with 8 stab wounds to his face, head and neck, and 9 to his back. Sarah was discovered in the basement and had been stabbed 24 times in the heart, face, head, neck, chest and abdomen. The brutality of the murders was staggering, and investigators quickly homed in on Holly and Sandra as the prime suspects. They tracked Carl's mobile phone, which led them straight to Tybee Island. At 9 a.m. they located Carl's abandoned truck and saw that it was filled with bloody clothes and the murder weapons. The net was closing in, and as soon as Carl's phone was switched on again, law enforcement knew exactly where to find the girls. 25 officers descended on the house where they were staying, and Holly and Sandra were swiftly arrested and found to be armed with knives stolen from the boys' house. It's possible the girls had planned to rob and maybe even kill the family that had taken them in. Under interrogation, Sandra was cooperative and had soon provided a full confession. Holly, on the other hand, remained silent, her demeanour cold and unyielding. The media soon painted her as a manipulative mastermind, with Sandra her lovesick accomplice.
In local news, 15-year-old accused murderer Holly Harvey and her 16-year-old accomplice Sandra Ketchum have both been indicted, and it has been confirmed the teenagers will be tried as adults. However, it is understood the death penalty has been taken off of the table.
On April the 14th, 2005, both Holly and Sandra accepted plea deals to avoid a lengthy and doubtless harrowing trial. When the judge said,
"Holly Harvey, you have pleaded guilty to 2 counts of murder. Do you have anything to say for yourself?"
She replied simply,
"Yes, I killed them."
When pressed for a reason, she claimed her grandmother had verbally abused her and that her grandfather had hit her, neither of which was proven. She also said she killed them so that she and Sandra could be together. Holly received 2 consecutive life sentences, eligible for parole after 14 years. Sandra received 3 life terms. In a testament to the bond they shared, the two girls continued to write letters to each other for a while. But in a 2005 interview from prison, Sandra admitted that, while she would always love Holly, she had to let her go romantically, stating simply,
"She's just not right in the head."
Now age 35, Sandra was denied parole in 2019 and remains behind bars, a decision that underscored the severity of her actions and the lasting impact on the Collier family. Holly, now 34, claims she spends her days reflecting on the crime that changed her life forever and has expressed remorse for her actions. Whether or not she truly has changed will be decided in 2025, when she will be eligible for parole. The actions of Holly and Sandra continue to haunt the small town of Fayetteville, Georgia, and like the other cases in this episode, it's a tragic tale of lost innocence and dreadful decisions. And as all those involved serve their sentences, the memories of their victims continue to live on. That's all from this week's episode and from the first season of Evil Uncovered. Thank you for joining us on this journey into the heart of darkness, and we hope to see you next time. Evil Uncovered is brought to you by Bauer Media. Concept and original stories by Steph Seelan and Lisa Howells. Episode written and exec produced by Lisa Howells. Produced and edited by Rick Simmons. AI voices produced and edited by Waldemar Matwash. Episode created with support from WeDaVinci AI Technology.